When the Oscar nominations were announced a few weeks ago, there were the usual controversies and omissions and surprises. And at least one nomination that was absolutely no surprise at all, because for the last decade or so, whenever this guy writes a film score, it is nominated for an Academy Award. More often than not, the great moment in the score comes in the end titles, because the composer doesn't have to follow an image. And of course, if you walked out, say, on Saving Private Ryan when the movie ended, you miss Him to the Fallen, for gosh sakes. And I think this end title is right up there with it. It's right up there, certainly, with the Lincoln end title.
Well, thank you, Jim. As a composer, we, and I think all of us, feel that end titles are wonderful because no one is speaking and there are no sound effects and you have the entire soundtrack to yourself for the first time in 2 hours, where so much of the music can be covered by, you know, spaceship noises and horses' hooves and whatever, people speaking. Quick, dense dialogue. So it does present a nice opportunity to review the themes of the film and make a kind of overture in reverse, if you like, where you can be reminded of all the themes that you may have heard or may not have heard throughout the film, the course of the film. So I agree with you. I'm glad we have them.
Yes, yes. And you sort of also feel sort of morally obliged to just look at the names of, you know, these hundreds of people that worked on this thing.
Well, that's also a lovely reminder of people, so many people that perform wonderful functions. A lot of people will grab their coats, of course, and get up and leave and find their way to the parking lot. But I think it's all a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously, John Williams has joined me this evening. We're going to be talking about the most recent of his many Oscar nominations, the one he just received for The Book Thief. We're going to be hearing that score tonight as well. John Williams, welcome back to KUSC.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Jim, always.
Now, of course, this is an area, this period in human history, that you know something about. I mean, well, you don't know firsthand. You were just a kid when the Second World War was going on.
Yes.
But you've dealt with it in Schindler's List, of course, and in Saving Private Ryan. This is a rather different look at that period from another entirely different point of view.
It is. I did not read the book. The Book Thief, I think, has been released several years ago, and it was a great success internationally, which I sort of noticed on the periphery a little bit. It was written by Marcus Zusak, who's a very young, I think he's still in his very early 30s. It may have even been in his late 20s when he wrote the book. The book was a great success, I think deservedly so. I had a chat with Janet Maslin, you know, the great critic of New York Times, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "The score to The Book Thief. Did you ever review the book?" And she said, "No, because it was released in the children's section of children's books, which Janet Maslin does not typically review." But she knew the book, of course. So my first exposure to the idea was the film itself. And it is, as you've said, a very different take on what is to most of us now very familiar history and a very unique piece, beautifully directed by Brian Percival, British director, and executed by a brilliant cast. I would recommend the film to anybody. It's a very thoughtful and very special piece of work, I think. Young Mr. Marcus Zusak, he's written other books and is writing more. And he tells me that he was very nervous about all of this because his first effort became an international success. And now here he is at 30 years old, worrying about whether he's going to be able to maintain this level of effectiveness. A nice problem to have.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's full of the book, which I read after having seen the film, is full of such wisdom. The kind of thinking that you wouldn't expect a 30-year-old man to be able to put forth.
I don't want to say this is a piano-y score, but the piano is very prominent in this. Does it have anything to do with the fact that at this period in German history, virtually every German household had a piano.
Could be. If that's so, it was an unconscious choice on my part. But the piano seemed singular. It seemed personal and private in a way. This, the orchestra plays in the film, of course, but it is true that the piano is a prominent thing. I can't really tell you why. It's like people say, why the piano? And it's sort of like asking an artist, why green and why not, you know, purple?
Sure.
The piano is particularly done, I thought, beautifully by Randy Kerber and our friend Gloria Chang, both of whom performed on the soundtrack together as soloists and other cases as two pianos. Two pianos sounding as one. Interesting, something I'd never done before. Actually tracing each other, playing at the same time, producing a different kind of reverberance than actually an echo chamber or an electronic enhancement would do. You always hope that these choices are the right ones.
Yeah. Well, I would say that's a pretty safe bet.
I hope so.
For people who have not read the book or seen the movie, it is a very unusual look at the Second World War, in that we are in the midst of Hitler's Germany. This is small-town Germany during the war, and the center is this little girl.
Yes.
So it's, I don't want to say inherently disturbing, but it is. It's just, there's something always at the corners, even in the happiest possible scenes. You keep telling yourself where you are and when you are.
Yes.
And you never completely relax.
Well, the Second World War for me has always been very real. I was a youngster in my earliest beginning teens when the war was going on. It dates me quite a bit. But I looked at the New York papers every day to see where the troops were advancing here and there, you know, and it's become something just implanted on my mind as our country and world has grown since that period. It's affected, it seems to me, the thinking of all of our policies and general directions taken in the you know, the two wars of the last century were colossal moments in human history. The thing about this particular book and film is that it does take place in a German household, as you've said, during the war, people who were not particularly political. But there's a double track in the film, which is that, as I see it, that we see this little girl who's unable to read or write, and the track that she's on, or that she shows us, is that one can achieve solace, one can achieve immortality through letters, through the word, through writing. Literature literally saves her life in the midst of this chaos. The other double track is the providential voice, in this case of death, who seems to be a very embracing and warm person who picks up a dead child and says his soul was as light as a feather.
Yes.
Which is a healing, a lovely idea that, like literature, death can offer solace and it can offer immortality of its kind. I mean, there's a parallel of these two things. And it seems to me that's the central thing this book tells us, that the girl's obsession with letters and compulsion to study and to learn and to achieve really saves her life. Shown in a way that I think in this particular book and film is quite unique. Certainly it is in terms of the materials that we've seen in the Second World War with all the fighting raging around it. We don't see any battles in all of this. It's all the effects on the ordinary domestic lives of people and the fear they have of the Gestapo hiding a Jewish boy in their basement. I think a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen the film, this little girl learning to read, she and the boy and her father paint letters secretly on the wall in the basement of her house so she can learn to sound them out and write them and so on. She begins to borrow hyphen steal books as she learns to read.
And then
seeing literature as a salvation.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, ironically enough, the great library in the book is in the home of the Burgomeister,
yes,
who is this Nazi. I mean, he's oddly enough played by the same guy who in War Horse was the rotten German officer who took the horses from the little French girl and then virtually condemned them all to death.
Mm-hmm.
This terrible guy. And he's the one who presides over the book burning,
mm-hmm,
which, you know, is another subject to be dealt with, because although Heine and Karl Marx and Freud, all of those books were certainly burned. The initial Nazi book burnings were of Weimar Republic pornography. Oh. Because, as you probably know, the Weimar Republic was noted for it.
Yes, yeah. For.
But, yeah, it's a chilling moment as the books go up, and this guy with a lovely library is saying these horrible things. Mm.
The library, actually, very beautiful. It's a beautiful house. I think it's in Potsdam, I'm told, and it was a headquarters for many things, including the German army at one period, and then the Allied people who came in later. It's got quite a history, that room. It's very beautiful.
Trying to talk about the harmonic language of this score is very difficult because it's a very unusual harmonic language. At least I found it so. And it sort of reminds me of something that Leonard Bernstein said about Benjamin Britten's music. He said, you know, on the surface, this stuff is very pleasant, very approachable, very instantly likable. And yet, underneath the surface, it's like there are these gigantic gears grinding against each other. And the harmonic language in this picture is not quite right. I mean, in the best and most conscious sense, I assume. Mm. You never quite relax listening to anything, even when the music is at its most serene and comforting. There's something in the harmony that just sets you a little on edge, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I presume that was entirely on purpose.
A difficult subject to put a hand on, Jim. It can be very elusive descriptions of this kind of thing. I think that what I would find in this is that the music is moving forward all the time. Time is passing. She's learning to read. She learns to read over a period of years, or a year or two, and in the music cue it may be a minute or 2 minutes. And we want to feel a turning or a churning or the evolution of time and the development of her skills concurrently with that. And I think that, at least on a functional level, the music can provide this. I would put it at the feet of the harmonic language, but not entirely. And it's also the metric approach of keeping things slightly off balance, where the gravity of things is a little uncertain. Combination of the harmonic language is actually quite simple. It's sort of in the pentatonic area, most of it, I would think. But things are displaced, suggestions of bitonality here and there, shifting of metric points of emphasis in a very subtle, quiet way. I must say, to put it, very simply, I enjoyed doing this very much because I loved what the film was about and what it was saying to me. I will just repeat, as I said earlier, this idea of the solace that can be found in literatures and is something similar to what we as musicians feel we find in music. And music can be something that is a lifetime obsession that is also a sort of life saver, if you like, in the way that this girl was saved by her books, her passion for books. I guess as we as musicians, our lives are rescued by the never-ending fascination with music and the desire to learn more and hear more and do more. The older we get, we realize that there's never quite enough time for it, and it makes living very exciting. Yeah. And literature and music share these things. As a description of the harmonic language is probably not a very complete one, but I would be as interested in the rhythmic aspects of it, I think, as anything else.
Yeah. And not surprisingly, the 1940s, the period of the war, I mean, it was the great golden age of classical music, both in Germany and in the United States, of all places. Mm-hmm. You know, this was at the Metropolitan Opera, for instance. The hottest ticket throughout the 40s was Wagner. Mm-hmm. Wonderful ironies.
A marvelous period of richness. Well, the 20th century has been, the earliest decades of it also, the First World War seemed to end an epoch very quickly. I think of Berg, Lulu, and Wozzeck. They were sprung on the world after centuries of development in music. And the 30s were very rich in this country. in symphonic writing in the United States. I guess somewhat slowed in the war, had to be.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story is when times are tough, music is one of the best tonics for anything.
Music and letters and literature. Again, back to the book thief. I mean, that we are sustained by these arts.
Yeah, absolutely. As we were listening to that, I asked you, do you have a suite in mind? Because I think of all film music being written, yours is the music that stands up best by itself. I don't think I'm betraying a confidence there.
Well, that's a wonderful compliment. If it where it can apply, I think it's great. I try to be careful, you know, Jim. A lot of my material that I don't feel is really right for exposure in that way. A lot of this music, all through the years of my music, I've played, introduced the suites at Symphony Hall in Boston. And just above the stage is the name Beethoven, above where the podium is. And it seems to, the atmosphere of the hall and the orchestra and the tradition in Boston and the name of Beethoven above one's head gives a different sense of proportion about what may be suitable for concerts and may not be. But when the music can be played by itself without the film, it does a number of things, one of which I'm very grateful for, because it enables us to present to an audience the skills of an orchestra, in some cases the virtuosic skills of orchestra, that are put into films that we do not hear or appreciate when we go to the movies. You come to a concert and you see 80, 90 people fiddling away madly, and this is the music you've heard in the film, but you realize that we can't make these films without the services of a great virtuosic orchestra. And people are, it's interesting, they enjoy, I think, the experience of realizing the kind of talent that goes into making these films. As a composer, I'm just a guy who puts little dots on a paper. But these people, meaning the orchestra players themselves, realize the music, bring it to life, create the sound, and certainly we're all interdependent. We need each other to produce all of this, and we need an audience. We need the third party or the fourth dimension or whatever to have the experience of the music. It's an exciting opportunity and a privilege for me always. When it can be done to take some of the music out of films and present them in suites for audiences.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the putting the dots on paper, because you still do. You still write music that way.
Whoa, Jim. You know, I am unreconstructed and antediluvian, I always say, you know. But when I was learning music, what little I may have, computers didn't exist. And so we had pencil and paper, and I've been so fortunately busy in my life that I really have not had time to go back, not literally, not the time to go back and retool. So I'm still writing every note with a pencil and paper. My hand is still holding up all right. It hasn't cramped out too badly yet or at all. So the main difference that it draws between me and my contemporary colleagues is that I'm a slower. They will go more quickly with their computers. They can type out the 32-note scale in a flash, where I'm obliged still to write every one.
Well, there you go. And the man who is, I think, the greatest prose stylist in the English language, John le Carré, I think he's the great novelist of our time. He writes everything in pencil.
Does he?
Yes, in notebooks. Uh-huh. So, you know, if it works.
If it works. There, as John Updike used to say, pencil and paper, still good tools.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful poem by Carl Shapiro. It's a poem about his various glasses. And he said, you know, I've got these kind of glasses, I got these kind of, I got reading glasses for proofreading poems. And toward the end of the poem, he says, you know, what if I had to just make up poems in my head, like Homer and Milton?
Yes. So we could be grateful for these little Bleistifts that we've got.
There you go. Thank you. 49 nominations and counting, and it doesn't get old for you at all. You are just always as excited as you were for the first one.
It's true, Jim. I suppose like baseball games. I mean, you it's the one you're winning or losing, I guess, at the moment that really counts. It's also abstract. I mean, how you can be doing anything for 49 years is hard to and still be interested and still doing it makes me very fortunate. And your listeners probably understand that these nominations are made by the music branch of the Academy.
Sure.
And so in a sense, they're colleagues, and it's recognition from them that means so much. And I certainly never tire of it, appreciate it greatly, and can't even imagine who that young fellow was 49 years ago, what connection I may have with him. It seems like another lifetime.
Well, I guess in a sense it was. I mean,
it's very much so.
It's and whatever one does at any stage in one's life, what it really is a portrait of who you are at that moment. And that's yes. really all it is.
Time and place.
Yeah, yes. It is. It is. Do you ever get caught, like on planes or just by accident, seeing an older film and noticing your music, and do you react? And
no, I haven't seen them, Jim. Nor do I particularly want to listen to things that I've done. But I'm always working on something. Something
sure.
is on my desk, and that's where my mind is. Although recently, Steven Spielberg and I had to look at Jurassic Park. It was being reprocessed for high-density images and 3D viewing and so on. And I hadn't seen it in 20 years. I don't think Steven had either. And it was over, and we both said, well, that's pretty good. It was much better than we thought it was. We were okay. You know, it's a nice program, a wonderfully entertaining movie, I think, still for young people. So once in a while, I'm in a situation like that, I am compelled for one reason or another to look at something that's 20 years old, but mostly I will ignore them all. I don't have copies of them and don't particularly pay attention to them. Some of it may be better than I think, or some of it may be not so good. I don't remember, but for me, it's the present time and what I have to write after this very pleasant chatter.
Yeah, and, well, speaking of stuff coming up, Star Wars is on the horizon.
I know. Isn't it amazing, Jim? You know, Star Wars, all those many years ago, speaking of time, during the period of the making of the first film, George Lucas, the producer and writer of it, never gave any of us any inclination that there would be a second Star Wars. We thought, well, this is going to be a fine Saturday morning movie for the youngsters, and we'll move on. And here, all these decades later, he's done six of them. And now I'm told that there will be seven. Actually, J.J. Abrams, the director, is about to begin to shoot it. And my present plan is to write the score for it as an extension of the other six scores. So never having any idea that it would last this long. And actually, I think this is a good thing. If I'd known it was coming, it might have seemed an arduous task.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I don't think there's a sequel likely for this one, though.
No.
Well, same thing with the Titanic thing. I just, you know, the one, I was not its biggest fan. And in fact, when I was a critic, I'm the one that said, this movie is not going to make a dime.
Ah,
I'm the one who
said that. Yes. So. Well, I think it's very well known that George Lucas was a bit despondent after he made the first film, and his friends were all encouraging him, saying, no, George, this will be popular, it will be fine. So certainly we're not made to be the best judges, I guess, of what we do.
I guess not.
Critics, of course, we love them, but I guess we, in quotes, but we also need them, I think.
Yeah, well, Sibelius said famously, no one ever put up a statue to a music critic.
True enough. Not even Hanslick. He didn't get one, I guess.
He didn't. No, Julius Korngold. Mm-hmm. But of course, his greatest monument continues going on. Mm-hmm. As we were listening to that, you were telling me about a very important anniversary coming up soon at Tanglewood.
Yes. Well, Tanglewood, your listeners will all know, it's in Weston, Massachusetts, in the summer home of the Boston Symphony. And 2015 will be the 75th anniversary of Tanglewood. And there will be celebrations of all kinds. I've been asked to write a piece, which I hope to be able to do. And I hope it will be conducted by our longtime music director, Seiji Ozawa, who's been recovering, hopefully, very well in Japan from his recent illness. And part of our earlier chat included a word or two about Ned Roram, who I think has agreed also, I understand, to write a piece for 2015. So I will understand that it makes Ned Roram and me the oldest two contributors for that event, but I look forward to it very much. I love Tanglewood. Jim, if you don't stop me, I will do a full-length commercial for the place and invite everyone listening to come there and be with us.
It really is a magical place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when I worked for a radio station in Boston, WCRB, we recorded the Boston Symphony, and part of the job was going out to Tanglewood, a rough job. Somebody had to do it. And I remember a rehearsal, Lenny working with the student orchestra, and it was terrific. And at one point, a bird on the stage flew up between Lenny's legs and took off.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and it was,
wonderful. Well, I remember many moments with Lenny at Tanglewood, especially the Beethoven 7, the last one that he did there,
which
was so unbelievably great. Student orchestra is the highest level, I guess, of the studies of that kind in this country. I believe it to be. The orchestra, you can close your eyes and you think it's the Berlin Philharmonic or the Boston Symphony. It's amazing what they will accomplish.
Yeah. And talk about great orchestras. The orchestra on this particular gig, there really isn't a better orchestra on earth. I mean, there are no better musicians. I mean, there's a broken record on this subject.
Yes.
But the greatest musicians on earth are the ones who work in the Hollywood studios because they have no choice. If they weren't, they couldn't do their jobs.
Yeah. It's at this very high level, Jim, here in Hollywood, and soundtrack musicians, the musicians performing on soundtracks all through the decades. It really began as early as the 30s with the beginning of all of this. Courtesy of Mr. Hitler, so many Europeans would come here to find escape, some sunshine, of course, but also some work. And the level of string playing here in the 30s and 40s, very, very high. It continues to be. So the players are at a level of major symphony orchestras and are, to a great extent, unappreciated. And it's another reason, earlier in our chat this evening, I was saying another reason why I have so much pleasure from presenting film music to live audiences, because it demonstrates what these people here in Hollywood in the studios do every day. Technically, their level of anything that we've got, and from the point of view of comprehension of what's put in front of them, and certainly sight-reading abilities are at the highest level. So we're very lucky that these employment opportunities give composers like myself the artists that we are privileged to work with.
Yeah. In an area in which composers, this may be the last place on earth where composers are perfectly free and, in fact, required to do what composers have done from the very beginning, which is to say, deal with real human emotions and communicate with real human beings.
It's been a wonderful thing for music, I think, in many ways. That is film and the worldwide distribution of film, bringing music to so many billions of people that otherwise wouldn't hear it. Much of it is, in the service of a commercial product, but occasionally some cream does rise to the top, and we've had some very fine music. From my point of view, I think all of us, never quite enough. But at the same time, things are changing very drastically, Jim. We have the introduction of the electronic sources of music and so on, sound sources that are where the brush gets very much broader than the orchestra itself. And I think that the application of this in film, and worldwide success of film, will affect our concert composers more than I think they would really be consciously aware of. And that tastes and aesthetics and methods are always shifting. And here we are in the midst of a commercial world, really, of making profit-driven films, the music of which eventually, for better or worse, can have a profound effect on what happens in the development of art music created separately from film. So powerful are the technologies of communication now.
Of course. And, of course, it was in that commercial world that guys like Bach and Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven all had to live
True enough, yes.
Well, John, congratulations again. What a wonderful habit it is. It seems to be every score now.
Well, it makes me the luckiest person that I can imagine, Jim. I'm so grateful for the opportunity just to make the music and perform it with these players. and have the musical life that I have.
Well, John, come back soon.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. I will do that.